Let's get started then. Make sure, yeah, that's going like gangbusters. You said you were born in Louisville. When were you born?
1933.
And can you tell me a little bit about your family, your parents?
My parents were the children of German Jews on both sides. Mm-hmm. They were both born in this country. My father was in the wholesale variety store business. My mother was a housekeeper, mm-hmm. Housewife. They were mm-hmm. both very, very involved in Jewish communal life.
Okay.
From the time I was very little, I realized that what you did when you grew up is you went to meetings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you went to enough of them, my father said they'd elect you president. Mm-hmm, it was mm-hmm, pretty close mm-hmm, to the truth. Mm-hmm. So,
were they involved in civic matters having to do with race or religious
relations? Not really,
relations?
No, just not at all. Mm-hmm. But that was largely because in terms of their development, Judaic life was difficult, and so a lot of energy was focused by that generation mm-hmm. on improving Jewish communal life mm-hmm. through the creation of institutions that would serve the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
So it took about, you know, they were too, they would have been, had they mm-hmm. been another generation, mm-hmm. had they been my generation,
right.
they
yeah.
would have been.
Were you related to Arthur Kling?
Yes, his niece.
Okay.
His younger brother, Morris, was my dad.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I'd seen in a newspaper article that Morris was your father's
yeah.
name, so I just was wondering, but I had read a lot about Arthur Kling.
Yeah, Arthur was quite impressive.
He had a lot of, in fact, there's an interview with him. Okay. One of the questions I like to ask people is, how and when did you first become aware that there was racial prejudice?
I always was aware there's racial prejudice. That the age to which I sort of sharpened my perspective was when I was a junior in high school, so I would have been 16 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, for a problems class, we were also supposed to pick a paper on something that we wanted, something that was relevant that we wanted mm-hmm. to do a paper on, and I picked the status of the American Negro, which is what black people were called then.
Mm-hmm.
And the Louisville Urban League was then located down here, and I went down to use their resources, and I got all the stuff. And I think until I started digging in that, I hadn't a very full perspective
mm-hmm.
on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first real intellectual awakening. And then I went away from my first year of school to Indiana University,
mm-hmm.
and one of the first things I did, there was a student NAACP chapter,
mm-hmm.
and I joined that.
Why'd you do that?
Because it just seemed that, to me, that the situation affecting the American Negro stunk, and this was a group that was trying to do something about it. So
mm-hmm.
it wasn't because I had a special friend or any of that. It was
mm-hmm.
purely an intellectual, emotional, whatever kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't very, very active chapter. So,
mm-hmm.
and then my next experience, I guess, with organized efforts to do something about the racial problem in the United States didn't happen until I came back to Louisville when I was in my, well, I was real wrapped up in McCarthyism at that
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had to work my way through that, and in the process of working my way through that, I met Ann and Carl Braden,
mm-hmm.
and didn't work closely with them, but after working through that in the 60s when the civil rights movement started heating up here
mm-hmm.
and elsewhere, I started going to every demonstration there was and, you know, taking sides.
Mm-hmm.
I had a husband who was a trial lawyer who was sympathetic but didn't want to get involved,
mm-hmm.
Probably for economic reasons. And so I just kept pushing, and we kept schlepping our, we had five kids, and I kept dragging our kids, you know, to demonstrations. And then in 69, having worked through the civil rights movement, and then the peace movement, and the women's movement, I mean, I just went like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I really meant what I said the other day about the civil rights movement, paving the way
mm-hmm.
for all of us. I mean, we really, I think we learned so much, and
mm-hmm.
In 1969, I became president of the ACLU here at a time when it was just a really, basically a moribund organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I lobbied sort of on a feminist peacenik platform, race was not in 1969. There were no cutting edge racial justice issues being fought in the streets. There were over the Vietnam War and over the women's, you know, women's issues. So that was sort of my trajectory. I then went to the national board of the ACLU and was the national vice president for 12 years and on their executive committee. And I went up there expressly with a feminist slash minority with a perspective, with an intention and an agenda to improve the organization for women and minorities, because it was really, it was all white men. I mean, all white men. So that's my life in Louisville Civil Rights Community in a nutshell.
I want to ask him some sort of more in-depth questions. When you said that you, what year was it that you came back?
57.
And you said that you had known about the Ann and Carl Braden situation.
My father
sent
me newspaper clippings. My father was a progressive, and he was horrified. In fact, Ann went to work in his business for a year or so when nobody else would hire. That was probably largely Arthur's doing, because Arthur was sort of moving around the community. And Dad was in the running the business. But Dad was pretty horrified about this whole thing, and he used to send me all the newspaper clippings about the sedition, about the bombing and the sedition trial. Of course, that had been completed by the time I came back in 1957. The ACLU was founded around that case in 1955.
Okay.
So one of the first things I did was join the ACLU. I think they had, at that time, 110 members. I mean, it was teeny. But as I said, I was very concerned about McCarthyism. I was an English literature major, and it pissed me off that anybody would dare tell anybody else what to think or what to read or what, you know. So, I mean, it was just instinctively against my grain. So that's how I got involved. And, you know, my father played a role. He was very, he was pretty much in tune with all those things.
And what was, you said that you, you know, you came back, were you married by the time you came back? Okay, you were already married.
I had a baby was pregnant.
Okay.
We started very young.
Okay.
Very young.
Did you work at all when you came back?
No.
Okay. What was the first civil rights demonstration or action that you took?
Oh, wow. God, you know, I can't really, I'm not sure whether it was supporting the sit-ins at the lunch counters here, but I know I can remember being real involved in the open housing thing, but I can't remember, everything sort of was glooshed up together, and I can't, it's funny, I can't remember the very first time. I remember the very first time I walked a picket line. I mean, you know, but I can't remember that.
What was that like?
That was really scary. I was telling somebody about that the other day. It was very scary. I was a young East End housewife mother with five children, married to a trial lawyer, successful trial lawyer, privileged, very privileged, and gotten caught up in the United Farm Worker boycott and was very, very deeply involved in that. And supported it fully, and one day the nuns decided that we're going out to this Kroger in my neighborhood, and we're going to throw up a picket line. So I said, sure. And I think I even had my daughter with me that first time. And I'd never done that before in my life. And I was already, you know, I must have been 35 or 6. But I'd never done that. I mean, I'd just never done that. And I had an extraordinary, passionate regard for picket lines. Never crossed a picket line in my life. So that, to me, was a very powerful tool. And we go out to this Kroger, and all my East End friends use that Kroger shop. In fact, my sister-in-law came up, and I'm leafleting, and she's the only one I could turn away. I didn't turn anyone else away but my sister-in-law. I think she was scared to death at seeing me there. Took the leaflet and left. And it was very scary for me. My mouth got very dry, my hands sweated, my knees shook, and it was just scary. It was something I'd never done before. That was the first time, and after that it was nothing. I mean, it was really, really nothing. That was That's the one thing I remember doing, that, and I was a Jesse Jackson delegate for the his presidential campaign in 1984, right after his Hymettown comment. And those two times, I can remember feeling really nervous, because when I had to go to the state convention, I mean, like, there's zillions of people I know who knew I was a Jew. And, you know, you do what you have to do, but I think that anybody that thinks that people do those things mindlessly is if they don't, they're not affected, is crazy, because it's scary to step out of your role. So I don't really remember the first, you know, civil rights action that I took in a non-supportive kind of way. There was one time in the 70s when I remember we went with Sherry Hamilton, who was there the other day, on who talked incessantly on a bus trip to Charlotte, North Carolina, to try and get the Black Six out of prison. That was Ben Chavis and...
Oh, them, that Chavis case.
And they called out the National Guard, and I was just terrified that my husband, who was very uptight, was going to... I didn't want him to find out about before I left, because I knew if he found out about this before I left, that there'd be all hell to pay. And he didn't. And they did call the National Guard, and they were Klan. It was hilarious. It was, in ways, it was very funny. They had, like, 97 that day, and people were dropping. There wasn't enough water provided. And the Klan, probably 12 or 14 of them, in their horribly, you know, heavy robes, are lining the sidewalk. And in order to make themselves look bigger, larger group than they were, you know, we're marching, and the last four or five Klansmen would peel off and rush ahead and get, you know, so they were always refilling their, there was only 12 or 13 of them, and there were National Guardsmen on the roof with their rifles. And
wow.
Yeah. The worst thing that happened that day was the heat, though. I think I dropped 8 pounds.
Right. Now, you said that in those demonstrations and stuff that you did some of the open housing demonstrations. Could you tell me a little what you remember about the open housing?
No, I didn't do those.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, you did the fundraising.
Money.
That's right.
I didn't do those. My husband did that. He didn't do it either. Actually, what the ACLU did was it supplied objective observers.
Okay.
And they had great big buttons, and it said ACLU observer, and he was one of those. And I didn't do anything but raise the money. I had, at that time, in 67, my youngest was 2. They had them from 2 to 10. So, I mean, no one even had to tell me that I didn't want to put myself at risk, because who was going to take care of those kids? Nothing was going to happen. You get a rock thrown at you, or you get locked up in jail. But I couldn't even afford to do that with 5 little kids. So, I raised the money. He was the objective observer, and that was... You know, and that went on the whole time that the demonstrations were going on. And I do remember one fun time we had in Dr. Maurice Rapp's basement one Sunday. We got something like 25 people out of jail that Sunday. We had a big party in Dr. Rapp's home down 28th and Greenwood. And it was so much fun. As in all those kinds of social justice movements or group movements or solidarity movements, there was an enormous sense of communion, you know, with people that you never had met before. It was great. And anybody who hasn't had, I feel sorry for people who haven't had that experience, because it was just wonderful. And you saw a lot of that the other day coming back out. You just develop bonds that last forever. Even if you don't see somebody for 15 years, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it's a good guy. And I saw that when there was a march a couple of weeks ago to the police station in support of the mayor. And you saw some of that same kind of dynamic.
Well, that's
it. Was wonderful.
Yeah. When you said that you did the fundraising, was that under the auspices of the ACLU?
No, it was just a group of us that got, I don't think so, but I could be wrong. It was a group of us that got together that realized that we had to get these people out of jail as quickly as possible. In order to do that, we had to raise bail money. And I think a disproportionate number of us probably came from KCLU. But I think there were NAACP people in there and Lynx people. And
what's Lynx?
It's a black women's club.
Okay.
Sort of sorority, but sort of not.
Okay.
They have a house down on Broadway. on the huge house of 40th and Broadway, 42nd and Broadway on the corner. It's a clubhouse. Mm-hmm. They didn't have that then. But
how did you fundraise?
We just called up people we knew and said we need some money, and that was pretty simple. I mean, everybody was real keyed into that thing then. And we also raised money to run a full-page ad in support of strong open housing law. I remember that. And that was one of those ads with everybody's name on it. So that was my first experience with that. We did that a lot in the anti-war movement. And the pro-choice movement, too, actually.
What would you say with the relation was the relationship between all these different movements there in the when you start getting into the late 60s?
Well, there's no question in my mind that for white people, not so much African Americans, but for white people who were involved in the Black Civil Rights Movement, that especially for white women, it wasn't hard to make the transfer from the oppression of black people to the oppression of women. And it certainly wasn't hard to make the transition from the civil rights movement to the waging of an unjust war against people of non-white lineage in Southeast Asia. So I think for many of us it was really a seminal experience in building movements. I had been very peripherally involved in a very superficial way with the labor movement back earlier on, but it was very superficial, and I think a lot of the tactics that the labor union used were used by civil rights leaders, were used by anti-war leaders, were used by women. I mean, those tactics are just as true today as they were then. So certainly without the civil rights movement, I may have ended up as passionate a feminist as I am now. Although, I don't know, I really got my feminism was really spiked by a lot of young white women, young white women radicals, who came here to work with some SDS kids in the 60s.
Oh, really?
In the anti-war movement. And I was in the 60s, I was born in 33, so by the time 68 rolled around, I was 35 years old, and these are 23, 24, 25 year old women. And they were really, to this day, I feel a great debt to younger women who took time to try and educate me. We used to think we used to call it sensitized, but sensitivity. But they spent a lot of time with me, and I was an alien creature. I had a successful, economically successful husband. I had lived in a nice big house. I had five children. I mean, I'm like the farthest thing from a revolutionary that these SDS kids could make. But they spent a lot of time with me, and they made me see a lot of things, and I really owe them a lot. Those women, many of them, came out of the civil rights movement really burnt by the chauvinism that was operative in the civil rights movement, which I saw later when I was working with the farm workers among Chicano. My God, they're the most sexist group of people I've ever met, bar none. And so I think that all these things can be traced back to the civil rights movement, or an awful lot of them can be traced back to the civil rights movement, and the energy and the passion of the civil rights movement, and some of the bad things, like the sexism in the civil rights movement, really gave birth to this sense among a lot of women, white college-educated women, that this was inappropriate and there's something unfair here. And I think that was more true of the college-educated white women I met than working class. Working class women were always more radical anyway. You know, they knew who the enemy was. College-educated white women
had to be taught.
Didn't really didn't really get it at the beginning.
Well, one of the questions I have, and you just remind me of it, is what would you think was the role of whites in the movement here in Louisville?
I think it was probably twofold. I think it was the role I played, which was supportive. But I also think that whites served as a bridge, that the whites who were in the movement served as a way, as a bridge to communicate to the larger white population that this time had come. And so therefore to demystify some of the stuff that whites were terrified about, intermarriage and I don't even remember what else they were terrified of. changing the status quo. So I've always felt that some of the most damage that's done in a society is done by remaining silent. Mm-hmm. And that through language, just by defining things and speaking about things, you do demystify and make it more familiar to people and make mm-hmm. it less odious. I think that's probably truer and more visible or more palpable when you talk about what's happened to the homosexual community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that until people can talk about homosexuality and talk about, you know, sexual deviance, it's just this huge, monolithic, horrifying thing.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start talking about it, you just become a little more familiar. And I think mm-hmm. that whites have always played that role in terms of the civil rights movement, in terms of translating it to the rest of the bulk of the white community,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who you may not win over, but you mm-hmm. can neutralize in terms of some of the mm-hmm. resistance and some of the antipathy,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you have people who are bridge makers, bridge builders,
yeah.
that you can, as interpreters
yeah.
or translators.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what, you know, one of the major roles that whites played.
Yeah. They seem to have been particularly important in the open housing movement, as
when
I look at.
Yeah. I think it's
different, much more than open accommodations, for example.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Well, the public accommodations is so much a kid's thing, too.
Yeah.
A student thing.
Here, especially, it was really young kids, too.
Yeah.
What happens after, you know, after the open housing marches and after the Board of Aldermen passes what, in terms of civil rights issues or race relations issues, what's next?
Right now?
No, back then. I mean, what happened next?
Well, as Georgia said, what happened next was going to the state, or you said after the state thing.
Yeah.
What
issues or events?
I think elections, voting and elections have remained an ongoing issue, and you can see that in the opposition to the merger of the city and the county, that there has been a slow building of black power in Louisville and Jefferson County, and that's come through the ballot primarily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of time and energy has focused, sometimes successfully, sometimes not,
mm-hmm.
on winning places in elective office. Darryl Owen's campaign has been real instructive. He's an old friend of mine, and he and I
just interviewed him.
Both served on the State Central Committee of the Democratic Party. He was kind of a funny story. I was the organizer of the McCarthy campaign here.
Okay.
And one of the things that we beat the regular Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things the regular Democrats refused to negotiate with us on was the composition of the State Central Committee of the Democratic Party, which I never even heard of until 1968. Mm-hmm. Could have cared less about. But it was a party of 28 people. Four from each congressional district. We had seven back then. And they were sort of considered to be plums for the party faithful, and they were going to go up to Frankfurt every 3 months and shape party policy. And so in the McCarthy victory, my group forged a coalition with Darryl's group, which was led by Nora Bloom, a labor leader and
mm-hmm,
senator.
Mm-hmm.
Because the regular Dems didn't nominate one black.
Mm-hmm.
This was 68. So we forged an alliance with them, and we beat them. And Darryl and I both ended up with seats out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd drive up together, and they're horrible meetings, horrible, stupid. And after about a year and a half of doing this, I said, Jesus, Darryl, why do we do this? He said, well, I don't know about you. He says, but I'm the only one who'd be conspicuous by my absence if I didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
So. And Darryl's pretty timid now, but he was much worse back then. And his getting elected to fiscal court was a real accomplishment. He told you about the South End.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just beautiful.
It's basically what we talked about with his election.
Yeah. So slowly, there has been senior moment. Slowly there's been a critical mass of black
mm-hmm.
elected leaders in this
mm-hmm.
community, which is where the energy has gone there on economic development. I think the civil rights stuff everyone sort of felt that after the Voting Rights Act was enacted, you know, on the federal level, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. The question was really enforcement. And I honestly can't tell you that I've been excited by the enforcement of civil rights law in Jefferson mm-hmm. County. I mm-hmm. think the city and state human rights commissions suck. Oh. I shouldn't have said that. Yeah. But they're very weak. They're very weak. Yeah. Very weak.
Always have been? Or
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think earlier on there was more passion because it was new. Mm-hmm. And you heard the gentleman, you heard Lewis Cole talk about Martin Pearley.
Right, I interviewed him, actually.
Yeah, he's married me.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Mm. And when we split up after 33 years, I said, Martin, do I get my money back? And he looked at me like,
what? No.
He's a very nice man.
Yeah, very clear memory, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And he hired me, too, actually. My mm-hmm. first full-time job was over there doing women's programming at the Human Relations Commission.
Oh, really?
Commission.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then from there I went to the directorship of the ACLU and then I came here. Okay. So I've had a very sort of public activist kind of life, mm-hmm. which pays terribly, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the issues that I wanted to make sure we got to was about busing and mm-hmm. some of that issue. Mm-hmm. So could you tell me sort of how that case
sure.
developed and stuff?
Sure. In 1970, when I was president of the affiliate, I really did breathe some life and energy into that affiliate. It was dead. Mm-hmm. It was really dead. And there were a bunch of young Turks who wanted to see it remain, so that's where we put our energy. And one of the resources we had that nobody else in the state of Kentucky had was we had a tenured law professor from the University of Kentucky named Bob Sedler, who was also he was sort of a soulmate of mine. We saw everything mm-hmm. exactly the same way, and he was very ambitious, very mm-hmm. ambitious, and he had a huge trial lawyer's ego. You know, they do that. Terrible egos. And he had been representing SCAF in some cases up in eastern Kentucky, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, we really ought to do something about the schools. And so we conferred, and the board decided the time was ripe to do something about Louisville's school system. And in fact, he ended up being the lawyer of record in the school desegregation suit in Jefferson County and the school desegregation suit in Hopkinsville and the mm-hmm. school desegration suit in Lexington, Fayette mm-hmm. County. Mm-hmm. So we held hearings around the community to find out what kind of a school desegregation plan people thought they wanted. The black community was kind of reluctant to go for merger. In fact, very reluctant, because they were, at that time there were five. Am I telling you stuff that some other
No, people? Actually, I haven't heard this from anyone. I was just thinking that.
There were five school board members. There were two school systems, mm-hmm. Louisville,
yeah,
Jefferson County. Mm-hmm. The Jefferson County Board of Education had five members. Three of them were black. Joyce Howell. Oh, God.
What?
Joyce Howell.
Would either Woodford Porter or Carl Hines have been on it?
Yeah, probably both of them.
Okay.
And two whites, Carl, John Bell, mm-hmm. I forget. Oh, and Rabbi, ask me again in a minute. Waller. Rabbi
okay.
Waller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the black community was very antsy that if you filed a merge suit that they were going to lose their voices. And
yeah.
in fact, they did.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there was some reluctance. So to make a long story short, two school desegregation lawsuits were filed. Bob Sedler filed KCLU's. It was a strict Louisville school deseg suit. Galen Martin, who was the head of the State Commission on Human Rights, hated that. He wanted a merge suit, so he hired a lawyer named Tom Hogan, who was a very close friend of mine, to represent Lyman Johnson and John Haycroft. Whose
oh, okay.
name was mentioned the other day, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in another school desegregation suit. Later they got merged. The two suits got joined. Mm-hmm. So it ended up being one lawsuit. But it was very messy and very messy getting there because of all the different points of view about what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
From the moment that lawsuit was filed, or those lawsuits, the town began to organize. The anti-busing activists, primarily in the South End, began to mobilize support in opposition because they knew that out of this was going to come, because school busing was happening all over the country,
mm-hmm.
that this was going to be a fait accompli. And so they started having rallies in every single school, high school out in the county, you can imagine. Big rallies, too. I mean, they draw 300, 400, 500 people.
You running out of tape? I'm about to turn it over.
Go ahead.
Gotcha.
So the community is, so this is happening in all of our communities. There's absolutely no leadership being shown anywhere. So I started working with a group of ministers and good people like Council of Jewish Women and League of Women Voters to form a coalition. Ann Braden worked with another group called Progress in Education. Mm-hmm. I, under the auspices, my KCLU presidency offices, got together with Lewis Cole, who is the man who stood up at the meeting the other
day. I'm going to interview him.
Oh, God help you. He is wonderful, but he does talk. and a woman named Dot Ridings, who was the president of the League of Women Voters at the time, who later became the national president of the League of Women Voters, and now is running some big foundation. The three of us made an appointment to go down and talk to the Chamber of Commerce. And Chamber of Commerce used to be down here, and so we made this appointment. We'd go in and talk to them. They didn't know what the hell was going on. They had no idea. They were all they read was the Wall Street Journal. They had no idea who Joyce Spond, who was one of the anti-busing leaders, was. They had no idea about Jean Rufra. They had no idea that Todd Hollenbach, our county judge, was sending out petitions in opposition to busing. He was organizing the anti-busing opposition. Sending out petitions. That Harvey Sloan, our mayor, had gone to Washington and testified in congressional hearings in opposition to busing. This is the leadership we've got.
Oh my gosh.
And it was horrible. Nobody rose to the occasion in terms of anybody in elective office. Nobody in the business community. my family got out of the Chamber of Commerce at that time because one of the stores they owned was being constantly, the windows were constantly being broken because they wouldn't have put up and stop forced busing, that was the rhetoric, stop forced busing. So that started immediately before the suit was even implemented. Okay. The community was completely riled up, the Klan was very active. Mm-hmm. There was a guy named Bill Kellerman who came out of the labor unions who worked with this woman, Joyce Fons, on a SOC, Save Our Community Schools, group, one of the bigger ones. Smart guy too, I don't know what his problem was. At the same time that was going on, I was running for the General Assembly and the primary was going to be in May of 1975. The lawsuit was implemented after the judge was overturned by the Sixth Circuit, implemented in August of 1975. When I was, I got such wonderful memories. When I was running, I'd go around, knock on doors, and walked and walked and walked and walked. When I ran from my district, which is Mary Lou Marzian's district now, I was a named plaintiff in the school desegregation suit. The president of the organization had filed it. I had been an advocate for choice for years, and they got me on another thing, capital punishment. I'd been very vocal in my opposition to capital punishment. So I'd go to these homes and have these conversations with people, and I was all right until one of them would say, "What do you think about this busing? Isn't it terrible?" And I'd say, "No, I think it's a really good opportunity for the community." And then I'd stop and look at my list to see how many voters I had, you know, just lost in the household. And I actually, and then on the Sunday of the, before the primary, Right to Life passed out this thing of all the candidates who are running countywide, and my name had an asterisk by it. You look down above, it says, "Favors abortion on demand." And the people who were working for me said that all these old ladies came into the polling booth with this, you know, Right to Life thing rolled up. The day, that was in May, I started my job at the Human Relations Commission the day that school opened, the first day of busing. It's, the Human Relations Commission used to be down here on 7th Street, right across from police headquarters. Mm-hmm. The police headquarters is still there. I pull up, and in the parking lot of police headquarters on the opening day of school, every cop in town is out there in riot gear. It's all black. I mean, it was spooky. It looked like something out of George Orwell. Black helmets, black guard. Oh, it was frightening. It was frightening. They're all out there in line. And I walked into this building of legal arts, you know, into my office at legal arts building. And there are helicopters going around all over, you know, watching, and the school buildings all had numbers painted on their roofs so the helicopters could see where there was a riot and identify it by the number. Incredible, incredible precautions taking. It was sort of the shot that was heard around the world for about 5 minutes, because really kids were kept out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Some places where windows were broken. As I recollect, nobody was really seriously injured.
Mm-hmm.
My fourth son was bused that year, and there was a woman in the neighborhood who rolled this, you know, bunch of parents who, not a bunch, several, who rolled on the school buses for the first week or so. The opposition was very vocal. The terror in the community was palpable. I mean, people were terrified. I was married to a man who was kind of skittish anyway, and when I was asked to lead a program, we'd invited Pete Seeger to come. He was coming, and there was going to be this big rally down at First Christian Church, and they wanted me to sort of, and he said, no, you can't do it. He had, but I ignored him. He said, I can't protect you, and there's five children to consider.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He said, I'll do it, which was like the most radical thing he ever did in his life, and he did do it. I don't know why it was better for him to do it than for me to do it. I made $8,000 a year. He made considerably more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So people really were terrified. My children lost playmates. Writing groups that I was in no longer would let their children drive with me. There was a lot of ostracization. Silly stuff. I mean, it was really silly. My daughter was home last week and we were talking about it. And she said, yeah, I lost a lot of friends. She said, I just thought they were, you know. In a way, in retrospect, it seems so silly and so ridiculous, and you wonder what it was all about, and it was just about rapid social change.
Mm-hmm.
Too rapid in the eyes of, you know, these parents who, I don't think it was stopped too rapid for black parents.
Mm-hmm.
It was much too rapid for white parents.
Uh-huh.
So after that, after the initial burst of terror over the school, you know, the busing plan, we used to go out to every school board meeting. The school board meets on Monday or Tuesday, Monday nights, every 2 weeks at Van Hoos Education Center. And you'd go, for a while they had them around the community. It was the best thing that ever happened to the school system was the school desegregation plan, because you go out to a school board meeting, there'd be 300 or 400 people there.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody all of a sudden is really interested in the schools, and you had to elbow your way in. The Klan was there. I mean, the anti-busing people, the civil rights people, everybody was there. It was just great. It was very healthy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, the school system was forced to open up its whole operation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good. I would say that after year 4, certainly, things had calmed down to, so it was just like everybody had sort of gotten used to.
That long?
Yeah, I'd say. I don't think it was in that kind of turmoil, but you still had people speaking out against busing and how outrageous it was, and da da. And then, of course, what happened was a lot of the black children became victims of that whole thing because they were being disproportionately suspended, locked out of certain programs in the school system. So all of a sudden, you had a group called the United Black Protective Parents.
Yeah, I was going to ask about them, actually.
And they're organizing, you know, to try and protect their kids and taking a totally different position than the integrationists and the civil rights advocates had taken, for very good reason. So it was a great time to be alive. I'm just, like everybody who was involved in it, just heartsick about what's happening now. It's just, I just think it's terrible.
What do you think will happen?
I think he's going to close it out. I think it's going to declare it a unitary system. I mean, it's what they're doing everywhere. It'd be, John Hayward is a nice Republican. He's not going to
just sort of go back to local schools,
yeah,
kind of thing?
Neighborhood schools, which were all black and one, you know, it's going to be just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way it was.
That's interesting you said that, because I've been just sort of assuming all along it wasn't going to happen.
Oh, it is.
Oh.
Daryl and I had lunch about 6 weeks ago, and he said, you know, he said, what are they thinking of? He said, they're sound. He said, now they sound just like the white people who were opposed to school integration.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was an attorney in that case.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. He didn't play a very big role. He was in there for the NAACP. And
okay.
Mostly
yeah, what was because the only papers I've seen on this case are NAACP records so far. That's what I've gotten to.
No.
They didn't
do anything.
Okay.
They couldn't. They didn't have the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It was all right. Bob Sedler. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it was only Bob Sedler because he was a tenured law professor, so he had the freedom
so he
to
could do
that.
It. Yeah, that's it. Did you ever get anything like threats or phone calls
all the
or anything?
Time,
oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And
my kids were threatened.
Mm-hmm. How old were they by this time? They would have been.
Let's see. Rachel was born in 65, so in 75 she was 10.
That's the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 and up.
Okay. And mm-hmm. It was, and I remember one particularly funny experience. My middle son, Ben, still lives here. I had four sons, and my fifth one was a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, middle children are different. You a middle child?
Mm-hmm.
Middle children are different. So he was always, of my five children, he was the only one who was sort of fearful.
Mm-hmm.
He was very fearful of a lot of things. He was just wired totally differently. And Eddie and I were going away with my mom and dad for my father's 70th birthday. He was taking all three of his children and their spouses on a cruise.
Mm-hmm.
Something I said I would never do, but it was one that somebody else was paying for it. It was okay. And we were going to be gone for a week. And I had written an article for the newspaper, Courier. I think it was Little Times. It might have been Little Times. The point of view of school desegregation, the point of view of a white parent's point of view about school mm-hmm. desegregation, the benefits that would mm-hmm. accrue to my kids. So we're discussing this at the dinner table about this newspaper article I've written that they're going to print, and Ben says, and I said, oh, I'd call the newspaper and ask them not to do it while we were gone. And Ben says, you're not going to use your name, are you? And I said, honey, I said, there's no point in writing an article like that if you don't use your name. But that was sort of like, that was the way it was, you
mm-hmm.
know. You
mm-hmm.
thought about things that you didn't normally think
yeah.
about. Like call the newspaper and tell them, please don't run it.
Yeah.
And tell them back.
So you said that it took a while to sort of calm down. What would you say was your next kind of issue that you worked on?
Almost immediately. I started working on, I started monitoring the school system for suspensions
okay,
and the casualties, which
mm-hmm.
were black,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of this.
So you
I mean, right, almost right away, and tried mm-hmm. to get some relief through the courts and was told by our lawyer repeatedly that this is a political action you need to do. The courts won't do anything about this. This is not a legal issue. This
mm-hmm.
is a political issue. So we began to organize and try and run school board candidates. Oh God, I spent so much time trying to help candidates who would be sensitive to our cause. A bunch of us did that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we took the candidates we had and tried to educate them. I remember one night I had some people over for dinner, and the president of the school board at the time was a guy named C.B. Young, and he never had anything to do with black people at all. And so I had Carolyn Huddle, who was also on the board, and C.B. Young, and Ed and me, and I don't think Lyman was there, I think it was an all-white group, talking about, you know, the issues. And he wanted to be fair, you know, I mean, and we spent all evening, you know, talking about equity issues and race and stuff. And I'd forgotten how much time and energy we spent, I mean, a group of us, trying to educate the school board members and trying to get other people who were already there
mm-hmm.
elected to the Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, that took years. I mean, that went on for years.
Mm-hmm.
You might ask some of the people you're going to talk to if they were involved in any of that, because that was very behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is interesting. So it seems like education stays an issue. One of the themes of the book is going to be how issues, but basically when you look at the 1940s, the issues are education, housing, jobs, police brutality. And
still got
so
them.
I'm basically going to have an epilogue at the end where I basically say this is where where these four big issues are today, because they're basically the same issues
exactly
that they were there in the 40s. So just a couple quick questions about the KCLU before I ask some sort of general wrap-up type questions. Was besides the busing stuff, what other actions did the KCLU take specifically regarding race stuff?
The one that comes easiest to mind was after that, and that was Lewis Coleman. Have you talked to him yet?
Not yet. He's on the younger end, so I haven't gotten
Lewis Coleman came over to me when I took the job in 1982. And Lewis is such a mess. He had all these papers, and he's trying to prove to me that the Kentucky High School Athletic Association is discriminating against black. There are no black, what do you call them, umpires, referees, somebody who calls the game.
Officials?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No blacks. And I said, there's nothing we can do about that, Lewis. And he, for about 2 years, he stayed on my case. Finally, I said something to Bob Sedler, our tenured law professor and general counsel. Mm-hmm. He said, well, we could probably do something about that. And he filed a lawsuit and got relief from the court that said, yeah, that was discrimination. And now I guess it's still there, the bylaws of the Kentucky High School Athletic Association, was a very powerful group in the state of Kentucky because it controls all the games and who's, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, it's very powerful group in high school athletics, very powerful. We later had a problem with them over Title IX because I got deeply involved in Title IX stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the bylaws has this little asterisk under it when it mentions, you know, who the officials are, and the asterisk goes down here, and one black by court order, it says at the bottom. So, I mean, it's just
that's
unbelievable.
Interesting.
So you might ask Lewis about that Kentucky High School Athletic Association case.
Do you know when he started getting involved in, was he?
He was involved in it in the 70s when I was at the Human Relations Commission. He'd come over, he was at the Urban League then.
Urban League.
And Art Walters, the director, would fire him about every other month. And Lewis would come in and Lewis said, he fired me. I said, so, what else is new?
Mm-hmm.
And Art was military.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very proper, and Lewis is raggle-taggle gypsy, you know, in your face.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a real, I think there's a great deal of love and respect there now, but boy, it was very difficult for a while. Mm-hmm. So he was active in the 70s, mid-70s.
Okay.
He hasn't given up. He's just amazing.
Yeah. I was wondering if he had gone any earlier than that, you know.
My first recollection of him was when he was at the Urban League, and I started that job in 75. I don't remember him any earlier than that, although he might have been around.
Well, that's pretty easy to check. And just so I have it on the record, when did you leave the KCLU?
I left it in 1990 and took this job. I had no job, actually. I just left. I was burnt out. Oh, God, you never
just
thought anybody so burnt out. I'd go home and cry three nights a week, cry myself to sleep. It's a very abusive job.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Awful.
Work, a lot of work.
Well, it's not just that it's a lot of work, which it is, and I had no staff. It's that you're the spokesperson for the whole state of Kentucky for every nasty constitutional issue to come down the pike. Ten Commandments, abortion, death penalty, drugs, AIDS. I mean,
who
choice.
Who
Everett Hoffman, who was
and
wonderful.
And then he was just replaced recently.
By Jeff Essos.
Okay.
And I will tell you, and I think it's true, although only a woman might understand this, that it was a lot easier for a man than a woman.
Mm-hmm.
If a man says some of these things, it's one thing. If a woman says it, it's like...
It's a loony thing. It's
well,
a loony
it's
liberal.
Worse. It's worse. It's just not, you know.
Or I had a friend who used to always say, oh, that's just your soft-handed liberalism.
No, that's not what I mean.
Yeah.
No, it was vindictive.
Oh, really?
It was real meanness. It wasn't that at all.
Oh, so it wasn't patronizing?
It was mean, like you're a bitch, you know, Jewish antichrist bitch.
Oh, that
no,
kind
it
of
was
stuff.
Very,
uh-huh.
very mean.
Mm.
And they wouldn't dare do that to a man.
Mm-hmm.
Not dare.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, it was really interesting.
Yeah. So then you came onto this job and you've been here ever since.
Yeah, okay. And I love it.
Okay. I like to always end with a couple sort of general questions that I ask everybody, and they're sort of evaluation or opinion questions, I guess you could say. If you were writing this book, when would you a book on the civil rights movement in Louisville, when would you start it and when would you stop it?
I wouldn't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would acknowledge that I have to end the book,
yep.
but it hasn't stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, because, you know, I'm shaped by what my involvement, and I'm not sure of the history. If Lyman Johnson were around, you know, he'd give you a different answer. I think that probably a lot of it did begin when he sued the University of Kentucky to get into the graduate school. I forget what, that was in the 50s.
49, actually.
Oh, was it 49? So I think you could certainly measure some of it from the time that Lyman decided to buck the system, but mm-hmm. it may have been before that. I mean, I don't know what was, I was certainly not party to it.
Mm-hmm. Before then, yeah.
So it certainly didn't start when I started, and when mm-hmm. I was involved, there was already a good, rich history.
Mm-hmm. How would you say the movement has changed over time?
I think it's become more diffused and mm-hmm. in some respects harder, because it's not a lot of the things that the earlier movement was able to focus on as absolutely essential have been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
And achieving that hasn't really changed the infrastructure in a way mm-hmm. that is meaningful to an awful lot of lives. And
mm-hmm.
so you're talking about changing an economic system that's just very inhospitable to the African-American population and mm-hmm. needs to be remedied, and I'm not sure how. I used to talk reparations, but you can't get a grassroots movement around reparations going, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more diffused, and
mm-hmm.
some of that energy is not channeled in a
mm-hmm.
in a way to work really what seems like mm-hmm. meaningful change in a meaningful time frame.
Mm-hmm. What would you say have been the most significant, or what was the most significant accomplishment or single event or of the movement in the world?
Well, I think the open housing movement really was one of the, it was African-American led. It was taking on an inhospitable, resistant white power structure and getting rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the process of you know, empowering itself around the issue of housing, it was able to exercise some political will at the ballot box, and mm-hmm. I think that was, things I think changed from that movement on. Mm-hmm. Expectations changed among Black people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. so. I mean, mm-hmm. success will do that to you.
Uh-huh.
Well, we did this, why can't we do that?
Why don't we do the next thing,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. What do you think have been the most successful strategies or ways of approaching problems over time?
I can't begin to even think of a coherent answer to give you to okay. that question.
We'll skip that one then. Okay. A little bit easier questions then. Who do you think have been the most important leaders over the years?
Of the Civil Rights Movement?
Mm-hmm.
There have been so many. I think May Street Kid mm-hmm. was important. I think Georgia was important. I think Norbert Bloom was important. I think Frank Stanley was important. I think probably Bishop Tucker and mm-hmm. Reverend Hodge and mm-hmm. you know, that whole cadre of
yeah.
black church leaders were very important. There weren't that really that many Black lawyers, you know, back in, there was...
Not by that time.
No.
Yeah.
There really,
I mean,
weren't.
Earlier in the 50s there were,
yeah.
but before your time, sort of.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's it. And unfortunately, Hodge and Tucker and, well, which ones? Tucker's no longer...
Dead.
Yeah. And Hodge can't be interviewed.
Yeah, he's so old.
Yeah, and, you know, so there's that whole cut. A lot of them, I just can't have, just have to go through them, through their children, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing, which I'm going to try to do
mm-hmm.
a little bit of. What would you say was the extent of the relationship between Louisville and movements in other places?
I was unaware of them.
Okay.
I was really unaware. I mean, I think there was, obviously, the Louisville movement drew inspiration from other places, but
mm-hmm.
in terms of any formal relationships,
mm-hmm.
I am very unaware of it, insofar as the NAACP and SCAF
mm-hmm.
and organizations like that had little tentacles out
right.
there and there.
Yeah. And the last question I always ask everybody is, what makes Louisville's story interesting? I wish someone said to you, I mean, there's a lot of Civil Rights Movement books out there, every town has its story. What's different or interesting about the Louisville story?
Well, I think one of the things about Louisville that makes it interesting and very difficult is Louisville's always been on the cusp. It never has really decided whether it's southern, midwestern, northern. We sort of shift and move around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's made organizing and some of this the stuff really difficult, not to mention the fact that I think that the deniability in this community is like you could scrape it off the ground. It mm-hmm. is so us a race problem? No.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of, I don't know, having never lived anywhere else, that deniability is so bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe it's that palpable in other communities.
Mm-hmm.
And you couple that with the fact that we have this ongoing constant identity crisis. Well, these country clubs are out here, but I mean, look at the, what's his face, on Muhammad Ali, and they wouldn't change their letterhead for years. Did you know that about the Pendennis Club?
Yes, I heard that.
Wouldn't change their letterhead. I mean, it's just like such an anachronism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, and they're all dying.
Yeah, I heard that story. Somebody just told me that story
about
recently.
The letterheads.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, there is the best example I know of legal deniability.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is a great story, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't have to live here.
Yeah. But it's a good, for sort of capturing a point,
yeah,
it's a good story,
right.
I guess.
So I think that's, you know, I just think you don't, any community that denies like crazy it has a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you can't resolve any conflicts that you've got until you put them out there on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that comes to the surface in this police chief thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine a police chief not knowing that this
no
is
clue.
What they're doing to the community?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess they didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so out of touch.
Mm-hmm.
And living in their own little whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't give you a very coherent
answer.
No,
I think that's good answer. And actually, I'll go ahead and turn this off.